Okay, this time I really have totally lost count of what share we're on. I'm not, what? Yeah, no, I know which one, number share, I don't know which one we're on. 13, 14, something like that. Okay, so, welcome to those who came, to those who have been watching. I don't know how many people have been watching, but I've seen the numbers go up. There are sources somewhere in the back. I think I have this script memorized now. First of all, thank you to our sponsors for the overall program, for the matching fund, to David and Serena Kushitsky, in memory of Riva Kushitsky, Zichrona Levracha. There's sheets in the back, and to the Weinbaum Foundation for their generous sponsorship. Today is, in addition to showcasing the shiurim that we give throughout the year, it's also a fundraiser for university programming, for our daily programming for men here at Or Chaim, and for women at Olpan Haarot, which we've expanded this year, including stipends. Any funds today up to $10,000 will be matched. I don't know what number we're up to anymore. I have lost count at some point. We were somewhere over 8,000 last I checked. This year has been sponsored, if I remember correctly, by Rabbi Mordechai Turchiner and Karen Turchiner in honor of the members of the families of the members of the Kollel. I think that's all the announcements that I'm supposed to make. Okay, so the topic that I want to deal with today is industrial kashrut supervision necessary? So for those who know, Howie knows this well, one of my hobbies in life is to discuss issues in methodology of psak, right? Issues that are more expansive than local halachic questions, but actually touch on the more conceptual, the overarching themes that emerge in psak. And sometimes I like to do overarching themes, and sometimes I like to tackle it through individual tshuvot, individual responsa that address the issues with an eye towards to the more global underlying issues. So what spurred this one were two tshuvot that were published in the first volume of the tshuvot of Tshuvas Minchas Asher, Rav Asher Weiss. In the last few years, he's come out now with three volumes of his tshuvot, and he is, as people know, one of my favorite poskim and one of the most significant living poskim today. And he was asked in two tshuvot whether it was necessary to have industrial kashrus. Now that question, I'm going to draw on him a little bit, but that question really divides into several different issues. So anyone who's ever learned Hilchos Kashrus, has learned Yaradeya, knows that there's many, many, many things, many kulos, many laws that most people don't know about and are convinced are not kosher, right? The first thing that happens when you go through smicha and you learn Yaradeya is you realize that you are way, 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 way too stringent in your kitchen, right? Anyone who has not yet learned Yaradeya, if they see someone who has learned it cook in the kitchen, they are convinced that the kitchen is treif and not kosher. This is inevitable. In my house, Ora learned Yaradeya the year before I did, and you know, my family was mostly vegetarian growing up because my mother was vegetarian. So we really didn't have meat in the house very much. So I had no idea. I didn't have any mimetic tradition of any sorts. I had no idea. This was a gap in my knowledge. So Ora had to tell me, don't worry, when you learn Yaradeya, you will know that I'm not trafing up the kitchen. So things like bitul, right? If something not kosher falls in, it's less than 1/60th and you don't taste it, without getting into all the details, it is nullified. Done. And it is kosher. Unless there's an onion, right? The answer is generally kosher. Other things, right? Sveikos, cases of doubt. Often we can be lenient. Now, anyone who knows anything about industrial kashrus knows that this is not how industrial kashrus looks. They do not rely on bittul. They do not rely on nullification. They do not rely on emanus eid echad, right? They don't rely on the testimony of a single witness, right? They have a mashgiach, depending on the case, either a mashgiach tamidi or a mashgiach who yotze v'nichnas, who comes in and out, or they have cameras, or whatever the case may be, depending on the organization, but we don't rely on any of these kulot. Now the question is, why? So, that's the first question I want to deal with. So, that's unit one, right? Can a kashrut organization rely on the rules of bittul sabag erecha? They don't, but why is that? So, it starts, on a formal level, with, I didn't give you the whole sugya, I just gave you the line in Shulchan Aruch in source one. The Shulchan Aruch says, "Ein mevatlin iser lechatchila." While it is true that you, if a little bit of milk falls into your meat pot, it's less than 1/60, you don't taste it, it is kosher. You can't take a little bit of milk and mix it into your meat. That's called bittel iser lechatchila, right? You're not allowed to actively nullify. And even if it falls in to, let's say, 1 in 30, and now you could add, you can't add, you can't nullify it. If you do nullify it, you add to it such that it is nullified, in bishogig, if it's by accident, mutter, so then it's permitted. And if it was on purpose, aser l'mifatel atzmo, so the person who nullified it himself cannot eat that food. Imhu shelo, right, if it's his, v'chein l'mishin et mitbatel bishvilo. And if he nullified it for somebody else, or with someone else in mind, they also can't have it. Now, when we say that you can't nullify it for some, that it was done for you, that you now can't eat it, so what does that include? Right, that's ambiguous. Does that mean I ask Jacob to put milk in my meat? I'm not eating meat. Other way around, I ask him to put meat in my milk. It's not a halachic comment. It's just that I'm a vegetarian. That was not halachic at all, right? So I ask him to nullify the meat. Is that what we're talking about? Where not only do I know, but I told him to do it for me, or right? Even if I don't know, the fact that he did it for me means that it is now prohibited to me, and I can't eat this pot of milk, this pot of dairy. So the Taz in number 2 says the Hainu Dafka Shayoda Zeshinit Badel Avuro Vinichole. It's only if I know and I want it. Afilo Tzivoto. I don't have to tell him to do it. I don't have to go that far. But if I know about it and I'm okay with it, so then it's as if it was done for me, and therefore I cannot eat it. It's considered for me bittel iser lechatchila. Avalim lo yada mimenu. But if I had no idea what he was doing, shari le daharehu kishogeg. Because then, if I didn't know what he was doing, so then it was an accident. So then the question becomes in post-game, okay, fine. So I understand on a local level. But what happens, I keep forgetting to put this in, but what happens if I don't know per se, but the person who is being mevatel, the person who's nullifying, isn't Jacob. It is a company, it's a corporation that knows that they're going to be selling to people, Jews, non-Jews, everybody. Does that count? Is the fact that he knows that an Orthodox Jew who cares about kashrus may buy this food, does the fact that he does that, is that called bishvilo? Right? And if it is, right, then it would make sense. Then corporations, right, and to which industrial kashrus organization are giving echshirim, wouldn't be allowed to rely on bittel nullification, because since they're selling it, that includes the people who might buy it. And if we were to say there is no need for kashrus, right, for kashrus organizations, there's a need for kashrus, there's no need for industrial kashrus organizations, then, right, it's right, then people would be going and just checking ingredients and buying food. So in theory, it's for the Jew. So is that going to make it prohibited? So that is a machlokas. So you look in 3, Rabbi Kiva Eger says as follows: Ve'embido al hastam lemisha yirtze liknot harehu kimosha naase bishvilam biyichud va'asurim likulam tshuvot rivashtim in tzadichet. So Rabbi Kiva Eger cites a particular interpretation of the Rivash, which is open to a little bit of question, but this is the position of Rabbi Kiva Eger, that if it's someone commercial, right, it's a factory, it's a company, it's a restaurant, and he's selling food, so then since he is cooking for anybody who's willing to buy, then that's automatically considered, right, cooking for you. Fine, if that's the case, then meaning, unlike the Taz, even if you don't know, so then you would not be allowed to eat that food. So now, the simplest first question would be, okay, if we rule like Rabbi Kiva Eger, then yes, Kellogg's cannot, right, needs a hechsher, because if it put in 1/1000th of something not kosher, then it is not batel. The Taz, who says, no, it's only when I knew what they were doing. I have no idea what they're doing, right? I know. I look at the ingredients, the first ingredients. Not all of them are kosher. I call them up. I ask if anything was not kosher. They tell me, oh, meat, it might have been. There was something, right, which is, you know, less than 2% not kosher. I didn't know. So according to Taz, it should be permitted for me to have something that was made by Kellogg's, made by whatever corporation you pick, that has less than 1/60th of Isser, because I didn't know. And we could say that it's very simply a machlokas, Rabbi Akiva and Taz. Now, often people will tell you, well, yes, we need industrial kashrus because we paskin like Rabbi Akiva Eger against the Taz. Now, in general, that is true that poskim quote Rabbi Akiva Eger over the Taz. However, as right, Clapper notes, and this is the one in 7, that is not consistently held, right? The same posek who will say, we paskin like Rabbi Akiva Eger in the name of the Rivash, namely that when someone who's selling food nullifies it, you can't rely on bittul, will turn around the next day and say that we paskin like the Taz. Significantly, Ramosha Feinstein, who's one of the people quote, that say, we paskin like Rabbi Akiva Eger, in 4, in his well-known tshuvot about whiskey, says the opposite. He says, Kevin Shirov Ayayin Sraf, Nimkar La'akum, said, since most whiskey, hard alcohol, is sold to the non-Jewish world, right, the percentage of people who are buying it who are Jewish is the minority. Nechshav v'mashe naseh limkor kinaseh b'shvil harov. So therefore, one second, even if they added something in which wasn't kosher, he says, big deal. Right, he's talking about the sherry casks, right? You know they're putting it in, but they're not doing it for you. And Rav Moshe Feinstein famously permits whiskey, which was aged in sherry casks, because he says it is batel. What about Rabbi Akiva Eger? What about the Rivash? Rav Moshe says, so what? She'ein l'hashiv she'nasev b'shvil Yisrael amiyut. Because the minority of people who buy it is Jewish, not the majority, we don't take it into account. So Ezra Klapper notes, right, the poskim do not consistently rule like Rabbi Akiva Eger, which would, right, make you wonder whether in fact you can't rely on bittul. Because again, according to Rabbi Akiva Eger, presumably you cannot rely on bittul. And the kashrus organizations are right that if you if they add something in which is less than 1/60th, since they're selling also to Jews, you can't eat it. It's considered being mevatel for you. According to the Taz, it's not a problem. Ramoshe, well, often he paskins like the Rivash, like Rabbi Akiva Eger, sometimes, in very well-celebrated tshuvot that people paskin like, does not. In which case, the answer would be no, right? You are allowed to rely on bittul. Moshe, yeah.
Okay, very simple. In industrial kosher, just to let you know, a lot of companies do it as a marketing tool. It's nothing to do with kosher at all.
Okay, I don't want to get into politics. I want to deal with the halachic issue. I'm aware.
It's a marketing tool. They're not. They couldn't care less if Jews buy it or not.
Correct.
For cleanliness or whatever. So therefore, this wouldn't apply.
So well, right now I want to outline the argument. We'll come to it. But yes, I mean, part of the question here is psychology. Yeah. No, it's batel b'shishim. It's only not things which are, it's not chametz and pesach. It's not certain things, but most things are batel b'shishim, right? Basar b'chalav, treif, batel b'shishim. Right, batel b'shishim, that's it. Okay, then Reb Moshe Feinstein makes a different argument that kashrus organizations like to quote a lot, which is, okay, even if you don't paskin like Rabbi Akiva Eger, you paskin like the Taz, in 5, mikol makom, michu'ara davar lashkiach b'lo hagala. Still, Reb Moshe has this notion that even when something is technically mutter, when you're dealing with the public, you're dealing with something en masse for everybody. It's just, in Yiddish, pasnisht, right? You shouldn't rely on, right, kulos, you shouldn't rely on leniencies, and therefore you shouldn't rely on bittul, and you shouldn't rely on sveikos, and you shouldn't rely on single witnesses, and you should have a mashkiach, and all those things, because mechuar adavar. The revival cone goes further. Right, revival cone in the Badei HaSholchan says it's more than that. He said, if you have a hechsher, so then, it might be true what Moshe says, that they don't really care about the frum community. It's a marketing tool. There are people who, they want the frum community, they want the people who think it's healthier, they want the people who know it's vegan, they want the, right, all the people, all the things that kosher now carries with it. But he says, that may be true, but in the end of the day, once he has a hashgacha, if he wants to put in a new ingredient, he has to ask the mashgiach. And if he wants to keep the hechsher, he has to listen to the mashgiach. So therefore, once you have a mashkiach, it's not just the Taz, Right? Sorry, it's not just the Rebbe Akiva Eiger. Even the Taz would say you can't rely on Bittul. Because since he has to ask the Mashkiach, am I allowed to do this? Now it's considered Alpiv, that it's done by instruction of the Jew. So between Reb Moshe and Rebbe Akiva and Reb Feivel Cohn, and sometimes possibly Rebbe Akiva Eiger, so kashrus organizations say that yes, we can't rely on Bittul, we can't rely on Eid Echad, we can't rely on all those leniencies, because either we possibly Rebbe Akiva Eiger that once it's industrial, you can't rely on these leniencies, or two, it's at least pasnished, right? It's not the right thing to do. And three, maybe it's worse that even the Taz would agree that when you have a mashkiach who has some say, you can't rely on Bittul. But this all begs a very important question. This Rav Asher Weiss doesn't deal with, but I want to deal with it because I think it's a very important question. All of this begs the question. Because all of this says, if you already have an industrial kosher organization, then you can't rely on Bittul. But they don't ask the more fundamental question, which is, fine, so get rid of industrial kashrus, go back to when everyone read labels, and then you don't have all you possibly have is Rebbe Akiva Eiger, but you don't have Reb Moshe, because Reb Moshe said a kashrus organization shouldn't rely on leniencies. Great, so get rid of kashrus organizations, and go back to reading ingredients. Reb Feivel Cohn says when there's a mashkiach, they have to listen to him. Good, so get rid of the mashkiach and read the ingredients. Right? All of this is not an argument for why kashrus organizations have to exist. It's an argument for why kashrus organizations create more halachic problems than they solve. And this is what Ray Clapper notes in 7. And I'll tell you the story and then we'll read it inside. Okay? He had an interesting case. This is like 20 years ago. There's a milk producer in New England, Gorelick Farms. So I told Jacob about this. You're going to have to hear it again. I'm sorry. So they produce milk. At the beginning of the omega-3 craze, right? Everyone wanted fish oil with omega-3s. So they decided they were going to put in fish oil, but they chose a interesting fish. They chose a shark. So what happened? So the KVH took away their hechsher, and one of their competitors decided, hey, we can run a smear campaign against Gorelick milk. And they created an ad campaign, the theme of which was there's something fishy about Gorelick milk. Now this inevitably led to a libel suit. Because Gorelick Farm says, what are you talking about? Right? It doesn't taste like shark oil, it doesn't taste like fish. This is libel. So it came to court. Now let's read inside. Right, let's read what happened. So many years ago, Gorelick Farms decided to market its milk all natural, which meant that it needed a natural source of vitamin D. Sorry, this was vitamin D. It was even before the omega-3. I just assumed it was omega-3. Fine. And it chose shark oil. This had at least two consequences. Hood Dairy began running an ad with the tagline, there's something fishy about Gorelick Farms milk. And the KVH, this was long before I came involved, right? Clapper is now involved, but he wasn't then, pulled its hashgacha. Gorelick Farms sued Hood, arguing that the fish was imperceptible, and won. Right, so this was the interesting thing. It came to court, and the judge, it was a libel suit, so what do you have to do? We had to taste it. And he tasted it, and he said, you're right, it doesn't taste like fish, it's libel. And so the non-Jewish judge tasted the milk and agreed there was no fish taste. I therefore ruled that the milk was kosher because the KVH had pulled its hashgacha. Right? Why? And we'll see there. Bleich agreed. And listen to this argument. He says as follows. The judge taste test demonstrated that the shark oil was nullified. Certainly, the percentage was below 160 anyway. So the only remaining issue was deliberate nullification, meaning bittul chatchila, which makes a product prohibited to the person or person from whose benefit the nullification occurred. Rabbi Akiva Eiger states that a nullification done with no specific end user in mind, but rather for whomever will wish to buy, is considered to be done for the benefit of all eventual purchasers. One understanding of this position is that anything consciously produced with observant Jews in mind has that issue, even if the observant Jews are a trivial percentage of the intended audience. Right? We saw that that's an understanding of Rabbi Akiva Eiger and the Rivash. So he said, but wait a second, here's a catch. If this was before the kashrus organizations existed and people knew that from Jews read ingredients, so maybe you could say that according to Rabbi Akiva Eiger, they're producing for the from Jews. But here it's even better, because now the kosher organization exist, and they pulled their hashgacha. So what do they think? No frum Jew will drink our milk. So now we know for sure they're doing it not for Jews. So even Rabbi Akiva Eiger can't argue that this is for Jews. So what happened? However, by giving up its kosher certification, Gorelick Farms demonstrated that it did not have any concern for observant Jews, right? They said, we're putting in shark oil, big deal, so we're getting rid of the hashgacha. And therefore, the milk was kosher because it's lost its hechsher. Paradoxically, had the KVH accepted this argument and sought to restore the hechsher, the milk would have become treif. My contrarian ambition was to develop a list of products that were kosher only when unhechshered, as many industrial koshering procedures ultimately depend on some form of nullification. Note, however, that this broad interpretation of the prohibition is not obvious, either in Rabbi Akiva Eiger or in his cited source, Responsory Vash 498, and it's not followed consistently in practice today, quoting the Moshe that I just quoted by Whiskey. So, right, Klaber said, first of all, we don't consistently pass like Rivash. Second of all, maybe the Rivash in general wouldn't talk, didn't really mean this when the from Jews are such a minuscule percentage of who's buying. But whatever you think, for sure, when they lose their hashgacha over it, they think that no from Jew who cares about kashrus is drinking this milk. Therefore, you had a guy, it was less than a 60th, you had a non-Jew taste it, right? So you have kvela, which, without getting into machokas, Ashkenazim, Svardim, you had a kvela plus 60, right? Plus less than a 60th. You knew there was no taste, right? He was Mesiach Lefitumo. He wasn't talking about kosher, he's talking about libel law. And they lost their hashgacha, so they think no from Jew is drinking the milk. So now, the milk is kosher. But if you put a hechsher back on, so that means you run into the problem of the Badei HaShulchan, right? Because now the Jew is actually saying, yes, you can keep your shark oil because of bittul. Right? And you run into the problem of Moshe Feinstein, that even that's technically mutter mechuara davar, disgusting. So, right, Klapper said, I thought that this was compelling, but creative psak. And to make sure I really believed it, I went out and bought a quart of milk and drank a glass before posking that anyone else could do so. I think Ray Clapper said he might be watching this year. So kudos to you. But Dov Weinstein showed me that in a current issue of Tradition, my teacher, Rabbi J. David Bleich, makes the same argument, and here is his quote. Paradoxically, according to Rabbi Akiva Eiger, a product that otherwise would be permitted may become forbidden by virtue of the fact that it is certified as kosher. Products produced for the mass markets are not produced for the benefit of Jews. Accordingly, if some small quantity of not kosher ingredient is present but nullified, the product is permissible. The same product, if produced for a Jew, according to the opinion of Rabbi Akiva Eiger, even for an unspecified anonymous Jew, is prohibited. Kosher certification is sought by a producer precisely because he wishes to market his product to the Jewish consumer. Targeting the Jewish consumer as a potential customer creates a situation in which nullification is carried out expressly for the purpose of a Jew, and hence, according to Rabbi Akiva Eiger, a Jew may not benefit from such nullification. Accordingly, he's talking about stem cells, stem cell burgers might be produced that are indeed kosher, but they would become prohibited if labeled as such.
That's incorrect.
What?
They're not market for Jews. You have laundry detergent, you have salt, you have sugar. It's zero to do with Jews.
So in the end of the day, they do think that they're going to get a bigger market. The question of why they put achshirim on non-edible things, also for vegetarians, but also for from Jews.
They're nothing. They're such a minority. They're not doing it for them.
They're also doing it for Jews, and like I said, I agree with you that we can question whether it's only for Jews, but if it's even part of, right, he's careful with his language, right? He said even if he's targeting Jews as part of his calculation,
laundry detergent, things that have zero to do.
Correct, but that doesn't need a hechsher. This is not laundry detergent. I saw over Pesach someone posted on Facebook a huge, like, metal canister, like 50 feet tall, of rat poison, which a big picture, you know, the big skull and crossbones, and underneath a badatz ida charedus kosher lepesach. So yes, right, okay, so it's, I understand there are certain things that are not food, that they do it for whatever reason they do it, but partially they do it for Jews, because they know that even people who know there's no reason that tinfoil should have a hechsher, something tells them when they see two things, one with an OU and one without, that they just feel like...
marketing.
Right. Okay, but who are they marketing for, right? Partially for from Jews. Now, it depends which city, right? And it depends whether you're a national, international, or local company, right? A local producer in New York City, it's not insignificant, right? If he is in the Diamond District, right, and he's doing... that's significant already, right? Kellogg's, I don't know how significant it is for Kellogg's. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. I'm sure certain things, it's not significant at all. They put an extra because, okay, big deal. So we'll put that, we'll put halal, we'll put whatever. The same way people would put 15 hechsherim. How many more people do you get if it has an OU over if it has the Sadmer hechsher and the Bava hechsher and the Papa hechsher? I don't know. But they do it because what does it hurt?
The words he's using is kosher certifications.
I understand. I understand that maybe Reb Leich is going a little bit far because there are many reasons nowadays, while people do it. Now, part of it is, it's an interesting question halakhically. How would we gauge the fact that people use kosher to get other constituencies? Because then they're not doing it for Jews, but they are doing it to be kosher. Right? So yesh ladun, right? So I could hear the taina, but so far what we have, let me just summarize and then we'll take questions. So far what we have is, what? Ooh, car keys. Yes, I do have the car key. I think, or did I leave it on the thing? Yeah. Okay, so to summarize what we have so far, okay? So normally, when someone will give a shir on industrial kashrus and explain why we need mashkichim to not rely on bittel, to not rely on testimony of a single witness, and not to rely on doubt, and not to rely on all the different things we don't rely on, they will quote Rabbi Akiva Eiger, and then they'll quote Ramosha, and then they'll quote the Badei Shulchan, and they'll say, either we possibly could be give Eger that when something is industrially produced, so it's for everybody, including the Jews. And even if that's not true, it's not right that you should rely on kulos. And besides, once you have a mashkiach, so you have to ask his permission. But the problem with that is, A, we don't across the board paskin like Rabbi Akiva Eiger. And once you don't paskin like Rabbi Akiva Eiger, that all falls apart. Unless you have the Badei Shulchan. Maybe the Badei Shulchan doesn't. And Mechor HaDavar, and even Rabbi Akiva, and for Five Cohen only, right, beg the question, because they are really asking the second question, is, okay, once we have kosher organizations, why can't they rely on Bittel? It doesn't answer the question, why did we go from what existed before we had kosher organizations of reading labels to having kosher organizations? Which is why I brought in Rai Clapper, that there are cases where, yes, even if you paskin like all those things, it's true, you can't rely on Bittel. But it's because you have a hechsher in the first place that you created that problem. If you remove the hechsher, you remove the problem. Now, we can wonder, right, this is the irony, right? In a world where there are no hechsherim, so his argument doesn't work as well as in a world where there is hechsherim. Right? When there is a hechsher, so by taking away hechsher, you think you're not targeting Orthodox Jews. Right? Before hechsherim, everyone knew, in theory, that Orthodox Jews would buy even if they didn't care. Right? Okay. But the point is that in the end begs the question, which is, fine, but how did we get to this point that we're relying on this, that we're worried about this to begin with? We had questions. Howie, yeah.
Okay, so, I'm not sure if it works this way right now, but the London Bait Team used to work that a lot of the products that they gave Hechsher for never had a
sign. But then on the Hechsher, they have a list.
They have a list, so other people wouldn't know that it's there.
Correct. So in Europe, right, they have less, I assume, because of that, they have less, you know, vegans and... you know, natural, whatever, you know, who are looking at hechsherim, I assume, you know, as opposed to like the, you know, the OU, the OK, the Starkey, whatever.
And again, I'm not saying currently, but it used to be that the OU did not recognize some of the London Bait Team's hechsherim because they were soymeh on some of these things.
Well, that's
they were relying on the factory. They were
okay.
The list. Is
okay.
What they're doing.
Right, and look, there's a good argument to be made, right? Meaning, if someone just said, look, we don't consistently pass along the Rivash, and I don't know what Ramosh is talking about, Mechuar Adavar, and I don't know what the Balei Shulchan is talking about, that the Mashkiach is in charge, right? I could hear all those arguments. Meaning, even with all of those, you could just say, I don't agree, I don't agree, I don't agree. We pass like the Taz and done with it, I don't agree with the Ramosh, I don't agree with the Balei Shulchan. And if a kosher organization would say that, right? You're telling me that the London Bezdin say, I couldn't say they're wrong. I could say that's not the positions the kosher organizations in North America are relying on. That doesn't mean it's wrong, right? And, you know, and I'm not at all convinced it's wrong. I'm just saying it's a reality that's what they're on. Yeah.
Give me a background. this might help to also explain another thing. Originally, there was, forget Kosher Rosé, something that showed up once or twice here, it means nothing, quite honestly.
I don't want to get into politics, I know, okay.
The way it worked in the beginning was people would read ingredients. What people never realized was, and I'll give you a couple examples, there's an amount that can be put in a product
that's
not required to be
correct, and part of the problem is that...
worse. They were making cans of one time metal with lard.
Right, there were all types of things. Now, on a practical level, before we get to the last thing. So on the practical level, one of the things that happened, if you ask kosher organizations, will say, realistically, part of the problem is, and you know, I mean, I took your idea of the Rabbi Ganak. So, you know, he's the CEO of OU Kosher, so I heard a lot of this stuff. So one of them, yes. Certain things, you could look at the ingredients from today to tomorrow, and you'd have no idea that the can was produced with a lard film around it, in which case, that's a problem, right? There were other times that he said, yeah, this used to be okay 50 years ago, because ingredients, you know, as the ads go now, right, you knew what you were reading, right? But now, what is sodium I don't know what it is. I don't know whether it's kosher. I don't know whether it's dairy. I don't know whether it's natural. I don't know what it is, right? And even ingredients you should recognize, you don't recognize because, right? I remember one of my friends was drinking one of these drinks.
So now
that's less true in the States. I don't know what's true here.
So,
in the States, they've changed it a little bit, right? It used to be that anything less than 2%, now it's a little bit different because of allergens, right? Because now you have a different way because you have allergens, right? Where once you see there's no trace of blah, 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 you can be more reliant on that. So a lot of things have changed in the real, yeah? But it's true. Like they say a lot of things you just don't know what you're reading. Right, which is true. You have no idea, and that's part of the reason. Right, so on the practical level, part of the reason there's kosher organizations is not just we don't rely on Bittel. Part of it is really a very important practical concern: is that God knows what is in these things anymore. Right, I like you know, for example, not a kosher's example. One of my friends, I remember, he was drinking. He was drinking one of these. You know, what are they like the Bolt House Farm drinks, like a fruit drink. I don't know if they have it in Canada, right? Which make themselves out as healthy. So some of them are like fruit smoothies, which I guess are somewhat healthy. One of them was like a lemonade, and he's like, "What? It's all natural fruit. Look, the first ingredient is healthy. It's all natural cane juice." I'm like, "That's fancy English for sugar water, right?" They go out of their way to deceive you, right? So. Yeah, so part of the problem is that you need kosher organization because what am I looking at? I have no idea. Okay, it's also true, right, that even with all of this, and even with kosher organizations telling you they don't rely on Bittel, they don't rely on Sveikos, they don't rely on Echad, they don't rely on any of that, it's only usually true. So for example, you can look on the OU's website and they will tell you, right, this is not secret, I'm not like publicizing a deep secret, right? There's a question, there's been a question for a long time that everyone always asks, you're not allowed to have dairy bread. Okay, that's halacha, you're not allowed to have dairy bread. Fine, Thomas's English muffins are OUD. So everyone always asks the OU kashras, how can it be that they're dairy? Right? It's a problem of pat chalavi. And their answer, everyone always thinks that the answer is it's a special shape. Because one of the kulos that we have is based on one interpretation in the words ke'en tura, right, is that you make it in a special shape. So everyone always said, well, it's an English muffin, it's specific, we know that it's dairy. But then they say, okay, but that was true when the only people making English muffins were Thomas. Now people make it other ones, and there are ones which are actually parib, so it should be a problem of dairy bread. So if you look at their tshuva, and it's available on their website, or you can email them if you want the more technical one, I have it on my computer somewhere, right, they'll tell you the reason that it's dairy, it says OUD, is because it has... And I kid you not, less than 1 in 1,000 parts. This one I think is less than 160. Right, less than 160. It's like 1 in 100 or something like that of milk. So why is it D? So it's D because of Ramosha. But they say, we take Ramosha seriously, and we give Eger seriously, and all that for the purpose of kashrus. But for the Dirabanan, the Chumra Dirabanan of Par Chalavi, for that we're not worried. I asked them, then I followed up with this and said, what about Ritz crackers? Because Ritz crackers should have the same problem. People put cheese on it. They would put liver on crackers, right? And he said, and here is where he said, no, it's less than 1 in 1,000 parts dairy. Oreos, right? It's a well-known, not well-kept secret, right, that Oreos are pariv, right? Because they have, right? It's like, I don't even think it's bittel. That's something with What?
Dairy equipment.
It's not even dairy equipment. It's some of them are dairy equipment, but it's whatever it is, it's not dairy. I went to ask Reagan, actually, why does it say dairy? He said, to be honest, certain things are dairy because the organizations, he said this was the case in Thomas's. He said, why do you put dairy? He said, because Thomas's told us that the milk provides no taste. So why do they put milk in? Because everyone has this conception. You put milk in, it's creamy. So we put in enough milk so they see it on the ingredients and they think it tastes creamier psychologically. But it has no taste. Messiah lefitomo, it has no taste. So he said, okay, fine. So for kashras, I have to call it dairy. Because it's bittel. Bittel is lechatchila, what Ramosha, the Badei HaShulchan, etc. But even the kashras organizations are aware that this argument only goes so far. And the OU specifically tends to be pretty open and pretty transparent about it. If you email them, they really will get back to you. It's very helpful if you want to understand the realia of what's going in, which is where I learned a lot of sort of what's going on. You know, shir with Reganak would be the halacha, and then would be like, you know, hawk about what's going on at the OU. Yeah, Josh.
Is it possible to understand Rabbi Acre differently? That when he says that the Moshe Nasa Bishvila Biyichu, it almost is like a Brera thing? And then get rid of the whole thing, but then the whole industrial thing will fall away because it's irrelevant. As in, once you buy it, then you're determined.
Correct. So So that was one of the things I swallowed, right? Is that Rabbi Akiva Eiger, even Rabbi Akiva Eiger, it's not clear how he understands Rivash. And within Rivash, it's some people take Rabbi Akiva Eiger very expansively and they say it's Brera, right?
Yeah.
But that's very unclear in Rivash, and we don't possibly like it consistently. Right? Because if it was Breira, right, we couldn't do it for milk, we couldn't do it for anything. But that expansive read of Rabbi Akiva Eiger, most people don't in the end take, because that's an expansive read of Rabbi Akiva Eiger within an expansive read of the Rivash. Right? And the Rivash doesn't seem to say it. Right? He doesn't go that far. It's more of if he's actually taking into account Jews, right, even as a minority, but not a Breira that the second I buy it, it automatically becomes for Jews, right? You're right. If you took an expansive Breira that
industrial thing would fall away, then it'd always be a problem.
Correct, then it'd always be a problem. Except historically, right, then you'd have to ask, okay, that was true, then why did they never have kosher organizations, right? Which is why it's very unlikely to take the Rivash that expansively, right? I mean, you find tshuva after tshuva in the Rishonim that they would go and they would buy kompot, right? The kompot tshuva appears in every Ashkenazi Rishon, right? It appears in the Rashbam, it appears in the Rosarua, it appears in the Ravan, it appears in the Rav Yah, in Rav Yehuda Bar Avram, it appears everybody, right? We used to buy kompot, right? How do we buy kompot? Maybe there's a little bit of wine, maybe there's a little bit of this. Okay, it doesn't usually, it's batel, right? But if it was Breira, you're right, right? Every time, but we don't actually take that expansive read.
This is the lashon of kemoshen as bishvil biyichud is a
correct
Breira type of.
It's a Breira type of language, and some people try to do it, but it's based on a comparison that the Rivash makes from what's it called, from Maaseh Shabbos, right? It's like, right, it's not a Breira thing. It's a Maaseh Bishvilo and Maaseh Shabbos, which has nothing to do with Breira. You're right. If you took a super expansive Breira, then you would get there. But that doesn't seem to be how the Poskim do it. And again, we don't Poskim like him consistently, right? And I can, like I said, I can show that to you in Rav Moshe by the whiskey tshuva, and you can ask the OU what they do with Thomas's English muffins. Okay. So then, there's a third tact one could take, and this is what I call meta arguments, right? Which is sometimes Poskim make local arguments. And sometimes they say, no, this is how I think halacha should work. One thing you find a lot in Poskim, especially in Poskim in the 20th century in Israel, is the notion that psak for a community is different than psak for an individual. Right? You find this a lot in Israeli tshuvot, with the army, with the police force, with hospitals, with electric companies in Israel, with everything, right? You know, people like Rav Goren, like this is their go-to issue, right? Psak for the Tzibor is different. Psak for the Tzibor is different. There are poskim who said, okay, so my second question was fine. We begged the question by bringing up Rabbi Akiva Eiger and Rav Moshe and the Badei HaShulchan. Because in the end of the day, not having a kashrus organization would solve those problems, probably, unless we take the expansive read like Josh is suggesting. But maybe the reason we need kosher organizations, so one is the practical concern that Moshe raised, which is there's lard and there's ingredients you don't understand, and this is 2016, and you have no idea what you were reading, and you don't know if something's avida latama, right? The halacha is something is not batel, if it's put, is not nullified, if it's put there for taste. Especially in the realm of flavors, you have no idea what you were looking at, right? It was famous in America for a long time that there was a red dye for candy that was made from, was it beetle blood? something like that, right? Which is put in, I don't know, for taste, for look, whatever, it, right? And it's maybe avida latama, right? It's made, what?
Small cherries and the fruit cocktail were actually from a fish from Australia.
There you go, right? There were things like that. And those are called, right? And those are called avida latama, right? It's made for taste, and especially in the taste, and the OU will tell you this, that one of the reasons that it's so hard to figure out how to look at labels is because specifically the flavorings, right? You have food chemists, right, who are making a taste, which is maybe 1 in 100, maybe 1 in 1,000, but it's meant to add taste, and therefore it's not nullified at all, and you have no idea what it's made of. So there's the practical concern, right? So we can answer the question of, is industrial kashrus necessary, and say, maybe it wasn't in you know, 1850. In 2016, there's a very practical reason why it really is, because you have food chemists making tastes, right, which are made of not kosher things, and you don't know what it is, so you need somebody to tell you what's going on. And that's a good reason. That really is a very good reason. But let's leave that aside. Let's assume it's something that has no added taste, it's vegan, no GMO, whatever, right? It's the right naturally produced, I don't know what. Okay? So here, some of the Achronim make the following argument. Look in 8, from, in Dovid Misharim, and he's quoting the Yeshuas Yaakov. And the reason I put the Dovid Misharim and not Yeshuas Yaakov is a very fundamental reason, which is the Dovid Misharim is on Bar Ilan, so I didn't have to retype it, and the Yeshuas Yaakov is not. So he says as follows, Takana sha'osim litmidiyut. If you do something for a consistent base in a constant way, yesh lachosh gam lemeute demiute, then you have to be worried even for the smallest minority. And it's like the Ramban. Now, which Ramban? So I gave you a summary of it. The Ramban asked the following question. The Gemara, the Mishnah at the beginning of Maseches Ksubos, says that they instituted to have weddings on Wednesday night, so that if it turned out that the woman was not a virgin as she claimed, and therefore she had committed adultery, presumably because she'd had an affair during the period of Erusin, which is halachically marriage, but they aren't living together, so then they would be able to go to Beit Din. And then the Ramban says, but I don't understand. How many women are committing adultery during their first stage of marriage, right? They're in love, right? This is not the time that people, right? The beginning, what we would call engagement, except it's halachically marriage, right? That's not when people usually are committing adultery. So why did we make a decree that everyone should get married on Wednesday night? So the Ramban said, because we're dealing with a community. And when you deal with a community, you set up takanot for the whole community. And you worry even about the smallest minority. And the way the poskim say it is clever. And there's a lot of truth to it. They say this often in the case of pikuach nefesh. They say as follows. Normally, if someone tells you that there's a 1 in 1,000 chance that this is going to kill you, right? But it's probably going to make you better, right? So then you'll take that risk. Because 1 in 1,000. But if you are the FDA and you are now making a decision for 320 million people in the United States, so 1 in 1,000, right, do the math, is a lot of people. So as they say, when you're dealing birabim, hamiyat hofech liyot vadai, right, what's a 1 in 1,000 chance will happen to thousands of and thousands of people. So he said, if that's the case, we're worried that eventually it's going to happen, because it will. So some of the poskim, and this posek who turned to Rav Asher Weiss, said maybe that's why we have kashrus organizations. Because the question here is not me. I happen to be stuck in, right? I had a friend who was, whatever, a few years younger than me, who was in Gush when I was in the Kollel, who asked me, he recently spent 2.5 weeks in Patagonia. So he asked me his kashrus shailas. So sure, one person is off in Patagonia, right? How many frum Jews are at the tip of Patagonia, right? It's him and his two friends who got a grant from Princeton to go to Patagonia to write a short story. That was actually what happened. Fine. So he asked me kashrus questions. So what I'm telling him is different than what the leaders of the community have to paskin for everybody, because the chances for him, I can say, okay, there's, right, not that I did in the end, he brought his food, but I'm saying in theory, I could have told him, there's bittul, there's nemanos, there's this, there's that, you can, because who is there, right? How many people are going to happen? So I can rely on bittul, but if I'm now the posek, and I'm making a decision for everybody, and the question is it better to leave it without a kashrus organization or not? So this posek turned to Rav Asher Weiss and said, This is why we need kosher organizations. Because, yeah, it's a 1 in 60, it's a 1 in 100, it's a 1 in 1,000, but you're dealing with hundreds of thousands of Jews, with millions of Jews. It'll happen that one of them will eat not kosher, and therefore we have to worry about it. But Rav Asher Weiss turns back to him in 9. He says, really? That's what you're telling me? He says, mikol makom. He said, the Ramban, you're right, said that in the case of marrying on Wednesdays. But that's not the answer that anybody else gave. They didn't make any distinction between the majority and the minority. They don't hold like that. They don't believe that's true. Amnam says, and he says, and even if you want to say it's true, so it's only true when it's possible. And if it's not possible, so then you do rely on the majority. And besides, the question of whether you worry about a common minority, right, something which is not, which according to Poskim ranges from 4% to 49%, or what's probably actually true, what Rav Asher Weiss says, Rav Osner says, at Rmiyat HaMatsu is a something which is a minority, but you wouldn't be surprised if it happened. The fact that we worry about that, it's a machloket, it's a dispute whether that's biblical or rabbinic. V'sak David Rabban, I think even that's rabbinic. So he said, it's true, you can make an argument based on Ramban and the Yeshua at Yaakov, but most Rishonim don't say that. And what evidence do you have that that's a majority of you in Rishonim? Right? That the majority of people think that we don't allow you to rely on minorities and bittul and nullification in the majority. Who says? Right? Who says? And then he says. So he says, I'm not convinced. Right? He says, I'm not convinced halachically you're right. And therefore he says, on a pure halachic level, I think it's not true. Then he says, when we call makom, hanach lehem li Yisrael, im nevim, lo nevim hem, b'nei nevim hem. Right now I'll read the English. He says, leave the Jews to their ways. If they're not prophets, they're the children of prophets. And it's correct for the kosher organizations to investigate, search, and clarify everything as much as they can to avoid forbidden foods, which are not only forbidden, but clog up the heart of man. So here he makes some meta-arguments. He said, first of all, this is what Klal Yisrael is doing. And if they're doing it, there must be a reason. And he said, I'll give you a reason. Because especially the Mikubalim pick up on this line in Chazal that not kosher food is not just forbidden, but it's metamtem et alev. It clogs up your spiritual arteries. So he said, so there's a reason. You don't want to, right? The same thing with the FDA, right? The FDA doesn't want 1 in 1,000 people dying. Well, the rabbis or the FDA of the Jews don't want their spiritual arteries to be clogged with not kosher food. So he says, I don't buy. So he says, the Yeshua and Yaakov is a formal halachic argument. That is, when you're talking about a community, you have to worry about it. But he says, I don't love it on a formal level. But on a meta level, I hear it. On a meta level, I hear it. Now, the problem, obviously, is that all of this is great, except it's still true that until the 50s, 60s, 70s, right, and then it sort of exploded in the 70s, there weren't kosher organizations for all of history, right? So you have to ask for that, you know, in sort of the industrial sale, and you look at Rishonim, they didn't, right? They relied on Bittel and they relied on Sveikos, and that was for the community, and no one ever said this. So, on a formal halachic level, it's hard to justify, which is what he says. On a middle level, you can say, okay, but they couldn't do it, and we can, right? So, why not go for the better one, at least on a middle level? But then he says, you have a question?
I just want to say,
Right, so that's part of the problem, is that the bittul, right, you're assuming that when something is batel, it's not really kosher. If you just say no, it becomes kosher, or if it's suffix, now it becomes kosher. Correct. So there's two things, really. One is bittul, right? Nullification, it's easier to say yes, it's now all kosher. Even that's not totally clear, but fine. That's a machloket in how you understand a rush and a rajba and many other things. The other problem is sveka, right? Is doubt. In doubt, you could have something which is actually not kosher. You're allowed to assume it's not there, but it might actually be there, right? So those are different things that kosher organizations do. They're avoiding bittul, but also avoiding svekos. What? Well, yeah, and then one of the big modern questions, obviously. Right, one of the big modern issues, in addition to the lard and the ingredients, whatever, we should have mentioned it before, is bishalakum, right? Is the fact that a big problem is if non-Jews cook it, right, it becomes not kosher. So that's another reason to need a mashgiach. Again, that would answer why certain things need it, and not things which are not olal shulchan malachim, right, which aren't eaten at a royal banquet, or things which are eaten raw. right? For different things. There are all types of good practical reasons. But on the fundamental level, Rav Asher Weiss, and beyond that, there's also something to avoiding spiritual contamination. And he says, furthermore, it is clear that with regards to kosher, the courts and leaders of the generation must stand guard, set up decrees that are needed for the time. The Tur writes, in the name of the Rush, that even though one witness is believed in ritual slaughter, said the custom of the diaspora is not to believe butchers, but rather to appoint known people to supervise, and only they are believed. As in their times, they knew that we can't rely on butchers, now we know we can't rely on others when there's a temptation of money. Right? Rush makes a very simple argument. One of the reasons I think you need kosher organization is because it used to be you could rely on people, and now you can't because there's a lot of money in industrial kashrut. There's a lot of money. Right, I don't just mean in the kashrus. I mean in industrial food, right? And therefore, you need. There's also money in industrial kashrus. We know that. That's true. I don't want to talk about that because you're going to get in a rant. I don't want to talk about it. There's true. There's money in industrial kashrus, but the reason there's money in industrial kashrus is because there's money in industrial food, right? That's why there's money there. There's money where there's money. And he said, right, as they're concerned, they will stumble. We cannot rely on one who has a vested monetary interest. And then he. I just put three more points. He said, beyond that, I'm just summarizing the rest of the tshuva. He says, the cases of nida, kasher, and chametz, right, which are certain cases where we don't rely on bittul, we make you actually check. So he said, doesn't that show that you have to check? You can't rely on all these halachic these halachic rules of leniency? He says, no, because that's the whole point. These are exceptions, right? Normally, we do allow you to rely on these. The second thing he says is, I've tried to justify this need for kosher organizations by saying that we shouldn't rely on chazakot and we shouldn't rely on bittul and we shouldn't rely on all those halakhic rules, and maybe at least for a spiritual reason. But he said, remember, this is a meta-argument, and with any meta-argument, sometimes you apply it and sometimes you don't. It's more of a tendency than a rule. So he says, in some cases, we really do rely on chazakot for communal purposes. We do. Right? Example, we assume that 13-year-old boys have reached physical maturity and allow them to act as an adult, and allow them to round for the Amud, even though we know that not every 13-year-old boy has reached physical maturity in his bar mitzvah, right? That's a good example where you know that there are a significant number of boys who in fact have not reached physical maturity at 13, and yet we don't make you check. So he says, don't tell me that we always do this. We sometimes do. And therefore, he says, hence his argument above, that it depends on how onerous it is to check. So Asher Weiss, that's a very sort of moderate claim, which he says, look, halachically I'm not convinced you need it. Sometimes in communal situations we really do rely on all these rules, sometimes we don't. So if it's not too onerous, and how you define too onerous, I'm not going to get into, because that's subjective. So he said, if it's not too onerous, I understand there's a value to looking to be more careful when you're dealing with a community, because there will be problems. And then we can add what she doesn't add. And there really are real issues, practical issues, right? The coating of the cans, and the things which are made by food chemists for tastes, and bishul akum, right? All those things are real issues. But at the end of the day, there are still cases where he said, but if it's too onerous, or if it's too hard, right? Historically, we didn't have kosher organizations, and an argument could be made that in certain circumstances, you in fact wouldn't need it. So that brings us to my last point. I'll do this and then I'll summarize, which is often the danger with meta-arguments is meta-arguments can go in both directions. So Rav Asher Weiss presented the meta-argument for one side, which is when you're dealing with a tzibur, he didn't totally buy it, but he sort of bought it. And when you're dealing with a community, so we should look to up the standards. But I gave you from Rabbi Dr. Adam Mintz's dissertation on Erevin, Rabbi Price's argument for building the Erev, which is sometimes we do the opposite, right? Sometimes when we're dealing with the community, we don't look for chumrah, we look for kulot, because there's the counter claim, which is, yes, you want to raise your standards when you're dealing with everybody, but on the other hand, when you're dealing with everybody, right, you have to take their distress or their need more seriously, which would lead us not to stringency but to leniency. So I gave you his example from Erevin, right? In the last section of his essay, right, Price addresses those machmirim, the stringent ones, who tried to gather all the stringencies and declare the Toronto Erev invalid. I know, I'm putting all the political things in one share. I know. He responds there, and then we're doing child abuse the next year. I don't know what we're thinking. Okay, fine. We're thinking that we're not sleeping for... I've been up since 3:30 in the morning. That's what's going on. He responds to their claim by asserting that the tradition throughout the ages from the Talmudic period to the present day is to be lenient in the laws of Erevin. He cites a proof from the Gemara, which the Gemara says that if the rabbis restrict and do not allow the creation of an Eruv Chatzer on Yom Tov, there would be great harm, since people would forget and carry on the Sabbath. Right? Pais explains that this Gemara explains that being strict regarding Erevin leads people to sin. Right? Sometimes when you try so hard, so you make more things treif. If you make more things treif, then people won't eat kosher. Right? If you said, rely on the kulot, right? If you told people that it's not 1,000 things which are kosher, it's 10,000 things which are kosher, right? They might keep kashrus more, right? There might be more likely than if you said only 1,000 things are. So yes, right? The from community who will only buy things with the best of echsherim, so sure, you've upped their standards, but what are the people on the fence? Right, you always have to take in the opposite argument. So meta-arguments cut in both directions. Right? And then Rabbi Price at the end noted that his Erev didn't rely on Kulot. Despite that, he says it would be legitimate to rely on Kulot, but okay, that was the end of his argument. So what I want to summarize until now is, do you need industrial kashrus? So, okay, question one is the formal halachic one. Is, can you rely on Bittel? Can you rely on Sveiko? Can you rely on all those things? And there, so there is an argument to be made that once you have a kosher organization, you can't rely on it, right? Because of Rabbi Akiva Eiger, because it's made for you, because the Mashgiach is in charge. But that begs the question, because if you didn't have a kosher organization, it might not be a problem. So then you have to invoke meta-arguments or practical arguments. The meta-argument is, when you're doing something for a community, you want to raise the standards. The practical argument is, nowadays, you have problems with Bishul Akum on an industrial level, right? Of non-Jews cooking it, you need a Jew to turn on the flame so everything will be kosher. You have things which are made in a food laboratory that you have no idea what it is, but it's made for taste and therefore is not kosher and would make the whole thing not kosher, and that's a real problem. You have cans which are with lard. A lot of these things are changing because of the allergens, because now people are much more sensitive to things like that, which I don't know what that's going to look like in 50 years, and I do think that is a game changer. I'm not sure what will happen, but I'm predicting that things will start to change because allergens really have changed the sensitivity of things like the FDA. But there's the meta-arguments that you want to be more machmir of the community, but as I mentioned at the end, the danger of meta-arguments is it sometimes cuts in both directions. So on the one hand, you want to be more strict when you're dealing with a community. On the other hand, you want to recognize that when you're dealing with a community, you're dealing with people who can't really be that strict, can't afford to be that strict, which would push us towards leniency. People are coming in, I think, now for the child abuse one, so I'll take questions. What time is it? I have another 3 minutes. Okay, so one question and then we're going to have to stop.
The sap from the trees, they always thought there was no problem. Like, what's it called? The maple syrup.
Yeah.
There was no problem with that. There was. But what they found out was, somebody accidentally found out.
Where they used lard on the...
lard to sift it through.
Right. Right, exactly. So again, the reasons... So in the end of the day, I think, right, it's a good thing we have it on balance, right? Because of the meta-arguments of Kivin Gojra and the practical problems kosher in 2016. But again... Remember that this is an argument for 2016. What will be true in 50 years with allergens and the like? Right. Remember that once you lose the practical argument, what you're left with is the halachic argument, which is shaky for a few reasons. It's a good argument, but not an ironclad argument. And then the meta arguments, which can cut in both directions. So at this point in 2016, yes, kosher organizations serve a very important purpose. What will happen in 50 years as we become more sensitive to allergens and you can't get away with things like that and there's more transparency? I'm not sure. It's an interesting question, but this is the groundwork for the type of discussion people will be having over the next 50 years. In 50 years from now, I'll come back and then maybe people will care what I say because I'll be 78, right? Okay.